This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. 40 years ago, Deliverance shocked audiences with a story that people still talk about today. Group of regular guys with regular jobs in Atlanta go into the wilderness for a canoe trip, but when they meet the locals, they are forced to fight for survival. The film is famous for the brutal scene of male rape, the likes of which hadn't been seen in mainstream film before and rarely since. And of course, there was this. Faster. The famous dueling banjos from Deliverance soundtrack, Billboard hit, 1973. Deliverance was filmed partly in North Carolina. It's gone down in film history as one of the greats. The shocking violence and dark plot has left a distinctive impact on the movies that came after, and it solidified a stereotypical view of the South that still lingers. Here to talk about the 40th anniversary of Deliverance and its role in the canon of American films is Godfrey Cheshire. He's founding editor and film critic at Spectator magazine in Raleigh, now a filmmaker and movie critic based in New York, and joins us by phone from Kill Devil Hills. Welcome, Godfrey.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Also joining us, Bob Jackson, assistant professor in the English department at the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Bob, first, let's talk about the basis of the movie, based on a novel by James Dickey. Lay out the plot of the movie for us.
Well, it's a fairly simple plot in which four guys who are sort of bored with their suburban existence in Atlanta decide to go on a weekend canoe trip up in northeast Georgia, just before a dam is going to flood the entire area and basically destroy the wilderness. And things go awry, and you've got pretty much the plot of the story in your introduction there. So things sort of spiral out of control, and the next thing you know, they are dealing with dead bodies and trying to survive.
So why do you think this movie has become such a long-lasting, persevered so long in our consciousness and did so well?
Well, it was a good movie. I mean, it's very watchable. It's sort of like some of the great Westerns, I think. And it simply transports viewers to this other world. And aside from the graphic scenes of rape and murder and all that stuff, it's actually a very attractive movie to watch. You know, the sequences out in the woods are very beautiful. And I think people just got into that. Then you add in all of the, these extraordinary scenes, which, like you say, had not really been seen much in classical Hollywood cinema. And you've got something that's just like nothing else.
Godfrey, is this can we call this an example of Southern cinema? And if so, where is its place?
Well, I wouldn't use the term Southern cinema because to me that suggests something that is indigenous. And Deliverance, like pretty much all of the depictions we've seen in what up until that time and somewhat beyond, is a movie made by outside money, outside corporations, and outside filmmakers coming in to use or in some cases exploit Southern scenery and Southern subject matter. I personally use the term Southern cinema to talk about more recent phenomena where you have Southerners making films in the South based on their own experience, and often not funded by outside sources. I think of things like The Apostle by Robert Duvall or Sling Blade by Billy Bob Thornton, both films made by Southerners trying to reflect a real Southern experience and making the money, making the movies with their own money, basically.
Is there any value in trying to compare this to that thing we call Southern literature? Is there such a thing? And is there a trajectory in cinema? Does it sort of change its face over time, Southern cinema?
Yes. I think so. I think that the comparisons to literature are very interesting. I would say that we don't have really the equivalent of Southern literature until we get to a more recent history in films like those two that I just mentioned, and also the films of Ross McElwee, the North Carolina documentary filmmaker, who I think is the great pioneer of Southern filmmaking that reflects real Southern experience and Southern points of view. But I think over history, over like 90 or 100 years, you have three basic phases. phases. In the classic Hollywood phase, where everything was run by the major studios in Hollywood, you had a very friendly depiction of the South that I call the Bright South, which is, you know, the folkloric and the chivalric, you know, everything from Gone with the Wind to the films that John Ford made about the South. These are all very, very positive, generally, depictions of the South, although in some ways they're condescending or romanticizing. And then after that, from the 50s through the 70s, you have what I call the Dark South. And this is when Hollywood studios have started to crumble, and it's really the power of sort of a new generation of the studios, as well as independent producers, using the new freedoms that the screen has in regard to sex and violence to do different things, and in some cases sensationalize subject matter having to do with the South, which I think is very much what we see in Deliverance. And that trend also coincides with the Civil Rights era, and I think that there's no coincidence that filmmakers and people from outside the South feel a permission to kind of caricature and make negative images of the South because of the negative images of the South that are suddenly in the news and that are in popular consciousness due to the Civil Rights Movement. Although, of course, a lot of these movies have nothing to do with that directly. The South becomes kind of gothic and perverse and dysfunctional and all these negative things that we think of because of the new screen freedoms and because of the new public consciousness about problems in the South.
Yeah, and the fact, as you suggest, that it becomes kind of open season on the South is kind of fair.
Exactly.
Bob,
exactly.
Deliverance is responsible for a lot of negative stereotypes about the South. Do you think they have endured because of that film?
I do think so. If you take a look at, you know, sort of a list of films and television shows that has invoked Deliverance, either the banjo theme or the male rape sequence, you know, since 1972, that list is in the hundreds. I mean, it's simply, you know, TV show after TV show, from The Simpsons to who knows what else, and all kinds of films. I guess the most famous film in the last few years, last 20 years, might be Pulp Fiction, right, which has a similar male rape sequence, which just happens to feature a Southerner, bizarrely, in Somewhere Lost in Los Angeles there. So it's generated kind of a cottage industry of stereotype that just kind of has a life of its own. And I think a lot of younger people who don't have memories of the Civil Rights era or the early feminist era, which is another very important context for this film, I think, you know, they sort of see Deliverance just based on sort of this one thing.
Yeah,
and that is this ridiculous hillbilly stereotype.
But that is interesting, given the power of the themes, even in the film, the themes of the loss of wilderness, what that means, a kind of changing role for men, and what masculinity means. I mean, those are pretty present themes in the film. Why is it that the Southern stereotype is the one we remember most and best?
Well, I think that's kind of a pop culture phenomenon. You know, the novel, which Borman and Dickey really made an effort to adapt as faithfully as they could.
Borman, of course, the director of the film. Dickey, the writer of the novel. Yeah.
They got it as faithful as possible, but there's just really no way to get the kind of the depth of analysis and richness of characterization that novel has into the film, although I think that many of the performances are quite good. But it just seems to be something that is so intense and so startling and memorable in that film context that it kind of took over the film. And it's strange, too, because Dickey always denied that there were really stereotypes in the novel or the film. You know, he said, you know, people said that we depicted all the mountain people as depraved, perverted, and murderous. But that's not so, and the mountain people are going to have to realize that in any culture there are good people and bad people. I think that that's just erroneous to think that you could produce a narrative like this that's going to be, widely released Hollywood film and not have that, you know, single element really jump out at people and be memorable. Is a little bit naive in my view.
Well, what about that, Godfrey? Do you think it's even possible to make a film that deals with the South and not engage and somehow indulge stereotypes?
At this point, I think we're at a different stage of history and pop culture than we were at the time of Deliverance. Back in 2005, the Sundance Film Festival asked me to chair a panel called Southern Exposures that was with the directors of some new films about the South, including June Bug by Phil Morrison and Loggerheads by Tim Kirkman, both of them from North Carolina, and Hustle and Flow by Craig Brewer from Memphis. And I remember, talked a lot about stereotypes. That was almost the dominant theme. And the reactions that the filmmakers had, I thought, was very smart, which is to say you can't get rid of stereotypes, and it's dumb to pretend that you can or to avoid them. The thing to do with them is to play with them in ways that are, you know, show the reality behind them and do not take them more seriously than they deserve to be taken. They're part of the cultural landscape, and you can't get away from them. But I think part of the problem with Deliverance is that it depends so heavily on these stereotypes. I mean, I was thinking, you know, critics are big fans of making lists about everything, and I think if you made a list of the films that created and propagated the most enduring negative stereotypes of the South, I think Deliverance would have to be number one on that list. I don't know what would be number two. It might have starred Burt Reynolds, too, but I don't know what, what the competition is there. I mean, it really, really, that, and I think that that was very important to the way that the film was received at the time. Not only did it propagate these myths, but it also gave non-Southerners, non-Southern Americans, an excuse to feel superior to the South. And I think if you grew up in that era, the younger people now may have a hard time understanding this, you know, if they're Southerners, that in that era, which I remember very well, you got a lot of condescension and a lot of patronization from a lot of people from outside the South just for having a Southern accent, you
yeah.
know, or from hailing from North Carolina rather than Massachusetts. And this film, I think, really fed that more than any other sort of cultural, certainly cinematic specimen of that era. And, you know, it also fed a lot of negative stereotypes about gays. I don't think anybody would think that this hillbilly who committed the rape was based on any kind of sociological reality. It was a pure fantasy thing
yeah.
that, you know, had the permission of the culture. Imagine, you know, you couldn't do that at the end of the civil rights era with a black person. Imagine if that rapist had been black. That film would never have been made, and it would never have come out. But in fact, that film did get made and did come out in 1915. It was called The Birth of a Nation. When you could, you had the culture's endorsement, in fact, to demonize black men in this way as crazed rapists. Now you can do it in 1972. We need that kind of fantasy demon villain, and you could still do it with a gay person, because the gay rights movement had just started and just started to make people nervous, and so people could exercise these negative fantasies in a way that it wouldn't be taken seriously today if you did that. If you did it today, people would laugh at it.
What about that theme, though, of masculinity? I mean, here are these suburban guys out for a lark, mostly drinking beer and on a canoe trip, and let's have a little adventure, and then they really come to terms with life and death, and then the loss of the wilderness, the whole idea that the dam was going to drown a river. This is a very prominent theme throughout the film. Did it resonate then, and how does it resonate today? Let me ask you first, Bob Jackson.
I think it did. You know, among these contexts that Godfrey and I keep mentioning, feminism, gay rights, the civil rights movement, another one is the environmental movement. And even in the novel, there's a reference to creating a colony when Ed Gentry says to the character, Lewis Medlock, why don't you go and create a utopian community of your own? And this is something that the 1960s and 70s actually, you know, saw a good deal of. It was sort of like the mid-19th century all over again, with people dropping out of society. So, yeah, that aspect of the film certainly would have resonated. And another really crucial context out there in the woods is Vietnam. You know, as these guys are sort of coming to terms with all these things that have gone wrong, and trying to sort of sort out whether the law even exists and what kind of choices that they have to make on an ethical or moral basis. You know, it would be very difficult, I think, for viewers not to see those beautiful mountain scenes and, you know, sort of the sense of confusion and fear about who is observing them and maybe eager to shoot at them as soon as they step out in the open in any other context than Vietnam, right? And this is a you know, an important era in filmmaking for new sorts of war films that are depicting the sort of moral confusion and that kind of, you know, imminent physical fear and paranoia.
Godfrey, what kind of influence did Deliverance have, and does it have today, if it does?
Well, you know, one thing that struck me is I've been surprised at all these sort of tributes to Deliverance on its 40th anniversary. I mean, there have been quite a number for the last few months. And the thing that surprises me is that it wasn't that critically hailed a movie in its initial release. It wasn't considered a particularly great or important movie by critics. I've been just rereading some of the reviews from that time, including the Vincent Canby review from the New York Times and Roger Ebert from the Chicago Sun-Times and Variety. I've got those in front of me, and they're basically mixed to negative reviews. Vincent Canby calls it a disappointment, and he faults James Dickey's novel for being lumpy and incoherent, and et cetera, et cetera. And so to me, the film has, in some ways, a greater life and cultural profile now than it did then. And I think this has more to do with audiences and the things that have stuck in audiences' minds for various complicated reasons. I think that some of the thematic elements we've touched on have to do with that and sort of the emotional power of the way that they're presented in the film. But I think the film has had a really interesting career, from one that had a really kind of a mixed reaction from critics and that did very well at the box office and got Oscar nominations, down to something that is kind of considered an icon now. And I think we could spend all afternoon talking about why that is so.
Well, we have no time left, so this part of our afternoon is gone. I want to thank both of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Godfrey Cheshire, filmmaker and movie critic based in New York. Bob Jackson, assistant professor in English department at the University of Tulsa in Oklahoma. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. Our website is stateofthings.org. Our producer is Alex Granados, associate producer Sean Wen. Stella Strohmeyer is our intern. Robin Copley is the technical director. Peter Bombar is on the board today, managing editor. Lindsay Foster Thomas and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.